Welcome to Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. Join us as we talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress. We had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Claire Minahan, who is the lead academic of the Sports Physiology and Performance Group at Griffith University on the Gold Coast in Australia. She is an expert in the area of physiological considerations for the female athlete, exploring the unique requirements for their optimal performance. We had an enlightening conversation about the normal menstrual cycle, amenorrhea, menopause, and harnessing your period to track your health, namely to help you identify any underlying health issues. It was wonderful to learn about the research she is doing and understand why it is crucial to do more research on women. We hope you enjoy it.
Me too. So it's so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us.
So I am Marina and...
I'm Shanti.
Hi, Marina. Hi, Shanti.
Hi. Hello. Have you had a nice morning?
A lovely morning. Thank you. Been out and about, being active, which is always a good way to start the day. And it's absolutely beautiful here on the Gold Coast in Australia.
Oh, my God.
We're in a beautiful place.
Whereabouts on the Gold Coast? Whereabouts are you?
Well, we're probably – the Gold Coast is just an hour south of Brisbane. And that's north of Sydney. And we are, you know, right near the water and right in the centre of the Gold Coast, actually. So, yeah, it's really lovely. It's still a small city, but big enough that it's got everything, but there's not too many people around. It's really beautiful. So and this time of the year, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. I've got family in Byron, and so I've been to that.
Perfect.
Absolutely beautiful. I mean, London, like, it sort of makes me feel quite sad. so great. Well, let's start. We're huge fans. We both listened to your Fight Science podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
We were recommended by a friend who said, "You've got to check out Claire. She's amazing." Would you mind like just introducing yourself to our audience and telling us a bit about what you do, why you do it, how you got to where you are, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll just start at the end and then I'll go back. So I'm currently on the Gold Coast at Griffith University, and I've been there for 20 years. And how I got there was an interest in exercise science at a pretty early age, probably about 13 or 14, and then did an exercise science degree at Deakin University in Melbourne. Found my way to the Gold Coast to do some postgraduate study, and that really began my interest in, actually at the time it was gender differences. I had a great-grandfather who was extremely encouraging of women being active and into sport. He was very successful himself. And as I started to do some research in the area of gender differences, I sort of found that he was reasonably prominent, so that kept my interest. And so I spent the next sort of 3 or 4 years doing a PhD in gender differences on anaerobic capacity and strength and things like that, and how women adapt differently to exercise and exercise training. And spent the next 10 years as an academic at Griffith University, continuing to examine gender differences in the response to exercise, and also the differences in the adaptations to exercise and training. And then I had a light bulb moment, if you like. I started getting a little bit bored with finding out that we were weaker and not as fit and not as fast. And it really came down to these anatomical differences and differences in muscle mass, and kept concluding the same thing. And so I really came around to wanting to optimize female athletic performance, and I knew I wasn't doing that by continuing to compare females to males. And so I started to look at unique physiological characteristics of women, and the easiest and most obvious is, of course, the sex steroid hormones. And so started to examine how sex steroids affected female performance. So dropped the men a little bit, and, we are different to men, but there's a lot to have been learnt from men. I mean, you know, over 99% of our DNA, probably more, is the same as men. So we can't throw what we know in the bin. We just have to, tweak things a little bit. So spent the next 10 years after that looking exclusively, I guess, or uniquely at women's physiology, female physiology, and how that affects the response to exercise, the adaptation to training, and of course performance and recovery. So I've been at Griffith for 20 years, and it's on the Gold Coast in Australia, and it's an absolutely wonderful place to work, a wonderful place to live. So I think I'll be here for the next 20 years.
Nice. Good for you.
That sounds lovely.
That balances out.
Yeah. Life. That's lovely. So can you tell us, like, can you just for our audience who don't know, I mean, because a lot of us don't, I mean, me and Marina only really got to grips with our own physiology in the last couple of years. Can you just explain, like, a monthly cycle, what actually happens to a woman's hormones, and what happens over life, because obviously menopause hits and things change a lot.
Yeah, it's I think over the course of a female athlete, if you like, there's about 7 different hormonal profiles that they may experience, and that's in a chronic sort of state. But if you look at the monthly changes in a normal menstrual cycle, and that's probably something we need to come back to at some stage during our discussions, but if you look at a normal menstrual cycle, we're talking about predominantly the fluctuations that occur in the female sex steroid hormones, estrogen and progesterone. And of course, men have those hormones as well, but certainly not in the same concentrations as women. And so when we talk about a menstrual cycle, we're talking about these that it occurs about on average monthly, about 28 days. And we begin the menstrual cycle, which is the first day of bleeding, if you like, or your period. And at that point, both estrogen and progesterone are at their lowest concentrations across the menstrual cycle. And that's called the early follicular phase. And then after about 6 or 7 days, estrogen begins to rise gradually. And between about 7 and 13 days, that's called the late follicular phase, estrogen continually rises and gets quite high. And we call this the ovulation phase, and that's when an egg is released. And estrogen is at its peak across the menstrual cycle, so at quite high concentrations, while progesterone remains low. So that's the ovulation phase, estrogen very high, progesterone low. Estrogen then falls quite rapidly over the next sort of day or so to enter the early luteal phase. And at this point, progesterone gradually rises. So we've got sort of average, concentrations of estrogen and rising levels of progesterone. And during the mid-luteal phase, this is when we've got elevated estrogen and elevated progesterone. So you can sort of clearly see 3 different profiles of estrogen and progesterone concentrations, that being the follicular phase or the early follicular phase during menses or your period, where you have low estrogen and progesterone. The ovulation phase, where you've got very high estrogen and remaining low progesterone, and then the luteal phase, where both estrogen and progesterone are elevated.
Right.
And how, what are the physiological changes? Like, what can a woman see during these different phases?
They are, you know, very individual. So aside from a period, so the withdrawal or the withdrawal of the lining of the uterus, and that being the bleed or the period, some women won't feel any different right across the menstrual cycle, and I guess they're the very lucky women that
I wonder what that's like.
Yeah, I wish I knew what that's like.
So there are some of those women out there that really only know that they have a menstrual cycle because they have a period once
they're
a month.
Having a time of their life.
Other women certainly go through some, you know, different feelings across the menstrual cycle, and there are varying degrees of disruption, if you like. And that can range from variation in how heavy a period is. It might be the complete absence of a period, meaning that they don't get a bleed. It might be very heavy periods. Might be associated with dysfunction or premenstrual symptoms that are very severe. So you're looking at cramping and headaches and feeling nauseous and all those types of things. And they vary widely from individual to individual. So, you know, it's very difficult to sort of summarise and say this is what the changes are in terms of how a woman will feel through her menstrual cycle. We know that in the first 2 years of having a menstrual cycle, that it's incredibly variable. Girls tend to get heavy periods, then they might miss a period. And so for the first 2 years, it can be quite difficult for girls. And that's probably something that we don't talk about enough to young women. We tell them this is what a period is and it'll occur monthly. And it probably is. Yeah, and deal with it. That's about it, right? You know, slap them on the back and off you go on your merry way.
Ever since I remember myself bleeding, the pain was excruciating. Like, I remember, like, even Shanti knows this, on the first day of my period, I cannot do anything. Yeah. I just feel so much pain.
Sick.
Yeah. And I was wondering, like, this isn't normal, is it?
But it is common.
Yeah, so that's a really good distinction, and probably one we don't make often enough. What's the difference between normal and common? So you're right, it is common. It does happen in quite a few women that they experience cramping and bloating and awful symptoms like that. And that could be at the start of the period. It also could be during the luteal phase, sort of the last week of the menstrual cycle leading into the period. Mm-hmm. But while it is common, it's not normal, particularly if it takes you away from your daily activities. If it stops you from training or exercising, if it stops you from participating in your normal daily activities, then it's something that probably should be addressed and by a medical practitioner, absolutely. That's the wonderful thing about the menstrual cycle, and it gives us an insight into our own general health as well.
Absolutely. And how do you go about really looking at it? Because the most cliche and classic thing that happens is you go to the doctor and say, my periods are so bad that I, you know, have these XXX symptoms, and they give you painkillers and they put you on the pill.
I mean, the pill is just something so easy that they just give you a pill.
It's a plaster, and it's just so common. And I've now known so many people who've had that as a response. And so what's a channel that you can go down that you
It's a really good observation. And while I don't have any facts or figures to support that kind of information, it's something that I hear as well, that is the response from general practitioners. And it's not to say that it's the wrong treatment, but it may not be the right treatment for everybody. And that's what we need to start educating women about. It'd be my view that you or an individual that has these severe symptoms that's taking them away from either training or daily activities, that they go and see their general practitioner. If they're not satisfied with the response, that they ask to go and see a specialist, and that's probably an endocrinologist or, in fact, a gynecologist. So they would go and see a specialist. And simultaneously, it wouldn't hurt to go and see a dietitian. And that may help some of those probably less severe symptoms like bloating and things like that. There are some things around diet that we could, assist with reducing that kind of symptom. But certainly if an individual isn't happy with the response that they're getting from their general practitioner, either change your general practitioner or ask to see a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm. And so what a normal menstrual cycle, can I just clarify, should be, I mean, is a little bit of cramping kind of like normal, should you say? And then, you know.
It's definitely normal. But again, I think that the determining factor is it stopping you from doing anything that you would do on other days? Yeah, so I think that's really important. So if you're going to define a normal menstrual cycle, if you like, it should have occurred sort of between the ages of 11 and 14 years. And if it doesn't occur by 15 years of age, then that may be a reason to go and see a general practitioner. The cycle length, so the actual length of the menstrual cycle should occur, or the period should occur between 25 and 35 days. And the actual period itself, so the bleeding, usually goes for between 4 and 7 days. And this one's a little more tricky in terms of its definition to the normal menstrual cycle, but how much flow or fluid you lose during your period, it really is only somewhere between 30 and 60 mils. So if you're out there and listening, go and fill up a glass with 60 mils, even the maximum amount, 60 mils, and realise how little it actually is. And it's very difficult to measure. Yeah, it's very difficult to measure, but certainly... if you do believe you're experiencing a heavy menstrual flow, and the definition of that is more than 7 days of bleeding, or needing to change a super pad or a tampon more frequently than every 2 hours. So if you're doing that every 2 hours and it's happening for at least 7 days, that is a heavy menstrual flow. And again, something that should be addressed.
And I'm just... So I have two questions. One is about what's happening in your physiology if you are, okay, amenorrhea is something that I think we'd love to talk about as well, but the other end of the scale, when you have irregular periods and also really, really heavy and really painful, I mean, do you know, like, what are the sort of, What are the problems? As in, like, what actually is happening in your butt, in your physiology, to make that happen? Because it seems like, you know, to lose that much blood, and for some people to not, I don't know anything about that.
Well, I guess you have to look at how the menstrual cycle is regulated. So you'd have to look at some physiology. So we'd begin to look at the HPA axis, which is the hypothalamus and the pituitary, and they regulate, and your ovaries, of course, and they regulate the menstrual cycle. So it's a feed forward and feedback system, whereby if things are normal and working correctly, the system works correctly, and they provide information to make sure that everything's working normally. Now, if there's a disruption to the HPA axis, a disruption to the hypothalamus, a disruption to the pituitary or the ovaries, that will then change the menstrual cycle. And that could either result in heavy menstrual periods, painful periods, or amenorrhea, being the absence of your menstrual period. There are numerous reasons why there might be a disruption to the HPA axis. One of the most obvious ones is pregnancy, of course, which stops a period. But it may include things like thyroid dysfunction, which would affect your pituitary, things like eating disorders affecting the hypothalamus. You can have stress-related hypothalamic dysfunction, a whole range of things. And I probably don't want to go too deep to alarm or alert anyone, but that's what we're looking for. We're looking for a disruption to the HPA axis caused by many different things. And that's right. Why the menstrual cycle can be a really wonderful tool to monitor general health in women.
Absolutely. I mean, because my second question was sort of going on from that. I mean, we've talked, me and Marina have talked about this, how, and there's been articles about how women's periods over COVID have become more painful, or they've changed in some way, they've altered. I think both me and Marina have experienced that in different ways, but I guess that's to do with stress,
and that's very well altering. It could be to do with diet, it could be to do with the amount of exercise you're doing, it could be to do with stress, as you said. So there's lots of different effects that could be causing a change in menstrual cycle. Absolutely.
Okay. And can we talk about amenorrhea and what it is? Firstly, why it happens and why is it not good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you're right, it isn't good. Primary amenorrhea is no period by the age of 15 or 16 years. So you actually haven't experienced a period at all, and there are girls and women out there that's the case. So that's primary amenorrhea. Secondary amenorrhea is where you have experienced a period by age 15. It may or may not have become normal over time, and then you have subsequently had the absence of your period for 3 months or longer. So that's the definition of secondary amenorrhea, 3 months or longer, the absence of your menstrual period for 3 months or longer. And again, it signals disruption to the APA axis. But I guess one of the sort of health-related issues with amenorrhea is the absence of circulating estrogen. So what happens is that we lose that fluctuation in estrogen across our menstrual cycle. We don't get the peak during ovulation, and we don't get the increase in estrogen during the luteal phase. And this has a direct effect on bone health. If you have lowered estrogen, your body's ability to uptake calcium and the digestive system is affected, and then your body uses the calcium that is stored in the bones for muscle contraction and all sorts of different things. And subsequently, your bones are affected. And so this can have two problems, particularly for athletes. One is the acute issue or the acute injury that may occur with lowered estrogen or amenorrhea, which is your stress fractures. And then from a chronic point of view, there is potential that individuals who have long periods of amenorrhea and aren't able to reach peak bone mass will end up with osteoporosis and poor bone health in older age, which can be absolutely devastating. So there's the two things regarding bone health. One is the acute injury that occurs in athletes, such as stress fractures, and then the chronic condition of osteoporosis in the later years. So, yeah, it really is incredibly important to have that fluctuating increase in estrogen across the menstrual cycle.
Absolutely. And thinking about, because I've been reading a bit about osteoporosis because I'm worried for my mum, and just learning about the impact the pill has on it as well. And, you know, it seems like weight training and putting stress through your body through weights or, you know, some sort of something like that, helps strengthen your bones. Is that something that, because obviously athletes do a lot of exercise. So part of me always thought that because athletes probably did lots of strength training and lots of ways to keep their bodies, you know, in peak physical condition, that might go some way to combat osteoporosis, even if they had amenorrhea.
Partially, but I think the most obvious thing is that athletes still end up with stress fractures, indicating that potentially their bone health isn't at its best. And if they have amenorrhea early in their career, then they will never reach peak bone health, or peak bone mass, sorry. And that doesn't occur until an athlete reaches their mid-20s. So if they're already lacking in estrogen and lacking in bone mass in the early years, they never have the opportunity to make that up. So the emphasis should be on reaching peak bone mass and trying to maintain that in the mid-20s and beyond that. I guess one misconception with athletes is that bone mass can be increased with exercise in general. What we know is that the bone needs to be stressed quite significantly. You did mention one way is through heavy strength training, and that's absolutely right. And in fact, there's a program called the Lift More program, which is for older individuals, older women and older men. And there's been some fantastic results in terms of improving bone health, even in individuals over the age of 65 with heavy strength training. What we do see in young female athletes who swim, for instance, or row, and they don't have that weight-bearing exercise in their early years, is that they may be at a higher risk of poor bone health as compared to female athletes that participate in weight-bearing exercise.
Wow. I didn't know that.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And can you just, for the geek in me, can you just explain? Can you just explain a little bit more about how putting stress through your body builds bone density?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert in this area, and I know that there's sort of this reabsorption of bone as well as being able to build bone. And what we want to be able to do in our early years is build as much bone mass as possible, and then from then on we need to be able to reabsorb and restore bone mass. Mm-hmm. And so that's a bit of a process of recycling and keeping our bone healthy in our older years as opposed to our younger years, where we're trying to increase our bone mass, not necessarily restore. We're actually trying to increase the mass itself. So they're the sort of the two different periods of life that bone is important, and the restructure is a little bit different to building bone mass, if you like. And taking oral contraception too early, and there's been some thought that oral contraception is good for bone mass, but if you take it too early before you've reached peak bone mass, it may actually be preventing the optimal bone mass reached in younger females. There doesn't seem to be a negative effect of oral contraception on bone health in older years, so from mid-20s onwards. But certainly if it's taken too early, there is some increasing evidence to suggest that it may prevent girls reaching peak bone mass.
God, that's really important.
It is very important. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I was on the pill by the time I was 18.
Yeah.
I had no idea about this. I mean, that was like, but it was the thing. Everyone did it. All your girlfriends are doing it. So you were like,
of course.
Jump on that train.
Yeah.
You'll have to get in the gym.
Yeah.
Can we talk a bit more about contraceptives?
Absolutely.
Well, so what impact do they have on normal, a more sedentary person? And what impact do they have on an athlete?
Sure. So hormonal contraception, I guess, is a generalized term for synthetic female sex hormones, and they absolutely alter the normal hormonal profile. So I've described what it is, a normal menstrual cycle. What happens when you consume synthetic hormones is that it changes that profile, so that progesterone and estrogen is absolutely flattened right throughout the menstrual cycle. But I must mention that, you know, there's 6 different types of hormonal contraception, one of which is the combined pill, and probably the most common type of hormonal contraception, and combined meaning that both progesterone and estrogen is delivered in a synthetic form. And what that does is reduce progesterone and estrogen right across the 28 days of the menstrual cycle. So it suppresses the natural hormones, and we have a increasing circulating concentration of synthetic estrogen and progesterone that remains level in a combined monophasic pill right across the menstrual cycle. So monophasic meaning just one phase, if you like.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I mentioned, there's 6 different types of hormonal contraception. So depending on which one an individual takes, it would have different physiological effects. But the main thing is that it changes the endogenous or the naturally occurring sex hormones.
Would that mean that the body then stops producing as much? So when you're off the contraceptives, you then have an issue.
There isn't enough evidence to suggest that. What seems to be the case is that women who have issues coming off the hormonal contraception, let's just say when they want to get pregnant, they've been on it since they're 18, they're now 28, they want to get pregnant, they come off the pill and their cycle isn't normal. And a lot of the time that's then blamed on the hormonal contraceptive pill. What occurs a lot of the time is that they never had a naturally normal cycling menstrual cycle. That wasn't established in their younger years. And it probably one of the reasons they went on hormonal contraception is because they wanted to manipulate and have a regular menstrual cycle, lighter periods, reduce menstrual symptoms, predict their period, and of course, you know, birth control. And they're the reasons, you know, for the most part, that women go on hormonal contraception. It's possible.
Acne as well, right?
What's that? Sorry?
Acne as well, right?
Absolutely.
And depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I remember my friends in school, because they had acne, they were given.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's absolutely
very early. Very early.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, so there's potential that they haven't established a normal menstrual cycle first, and they come off it after 10 years and it's still not normal. And it's been hidden, really, for the last 10 years, because the bleed that occurs with the hormonal contraception or being on the pill is really just a withdrawal bleed. It's not actually a physiological period, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, it's going back to the idea that your bleed is like, I think I've heard the term a report card. It's telling you how you're doing, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so one of our questions was to sort of say, like, how does an athlete or anybody identify an issue? And I guess it would be, is your period, you know, is it, you know, on a quotation marks, normal?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've had a period, The cycle length is between 25 and 35 days, and it's regular. The period duration is between 4 to 7 days. The menstrual flow is no more than 60 mils. You're not bleeding for longer than 7 days, and you're not changing your tampon more frequently than every 2 hours.
Okay.
You know, that is a normal menstrual cycle. If it's different to that, then I would suggest someone get an appointment with their general practitioner.
Go on.
I was going to say, what can they do? I mean, to track it, I guess, like you track it daily, you'd have like a, I mean, I've started doing this because to understand my mood swings and things and sort of understand, you know, how to train. I mean, you want to talk about training around your cycle and like, you know, so, you know, I guess tracking it and then understanding where you are would then dictate what's best for you to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the best advice that you could give a young female athlete or any athlete that hasn't already begun tracking their cycle. It will give them an indication, first of all, if they have a regular cycle, and also make them a little bit more aware of what their symptoms are, what their cycle length is, those types of things. So very basic things, establishing if they have a normal menstrual cycle in the first instance. And I think once we've covered off on health, once we're satisfied that the athlete is healthy, that the menstrual cycle is normal, then we can start talking about performance and training adaptations. But I do think that it's premature to talk about performance and training adaptations if we don't have a normal, healthy menstrual cycle and a healthy athlete.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense.
And then, so let's say we've got a normal, a healthy menstrual cycle in an athlete who is, I guess, in their 20s. And then I'd also like to touch on an athlete who's in their 40s and an athlete, you know, in their 60s as well. Mm. If we just go through those sorts of brackets, how would you train with the cycle? Would you go on how they feel, or would you make you look at the actual the 28 days and divide it up?
Yeah, well, the most recent evidence suggests that it should be prescribed on an individual basis, and so monitoring is absolutely critical and crucial, and that women should perform at a time that they feel that they can best perform, because there isn't strong physiological evidence to suggest that you'll perform better at any day of the menstrual cycle. There's just not strong physiological evidence at this point in time. So we are now suggesting that individuals should aim to perform on the day that they feel the best. And interestingly, if you ask athletes heading to the Olympics what day of the menstrual cycle will they be on during the gold medal match or the gold medal bout or the gold medal race, most of them won't be able to answer you. So I don't even think we've got the basics right yet.
Right. I mean, not many of them would have periods too, we've realised, after interviewing people. And they wouldn't,
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I don't think we have the basics right yet to be prescribing the perfect day for a particular performance, whether that be an endurance performance or a powerful strength performance or something in between. We don't have that evidence yet. When it comes to training, there is some emerging evidence regarding strength training in particular. Of course, there's evidence on both sides of the story, but there is some accumulating evidence. That is three papers of reasonable quality showing that strength gains are optimized when female athletes train more frequently in the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle as compared to the luteal phase. So if you break the menstrual cycle up into 4 weeks, which is often done in a periodized strength training program, you would have the period week, so week one. Week two is sort of the late follicular moving into ovulation, and then the 2 weeks of the luteal phase. And very often strength and conditioning coaches will break that month up into those 4 weeks, and they will be called microcycles. And every one of those four microcycles, and this is very basic periodization programming, but every one of those, one in four of those microcycles will be a recovery microcycle, meaning that they will work harder in the other three as compared to this recovery microcycle. What we're finding now is that if you put that recovery microcycle in the luteal phase so that you're working harder in the follicular phase, you'll get more optimized strength gains than the other way around. So if you're programming strength, you may be best off to put your recovery microcycle in the luteal phase.
Yeah. Makes sense. I was always wondering, during the, like, when the PMS emerges and you're feeling weak
as hell,
shoot, like I'm always thinking, shall I push through? Will that help? So what do you think? And then I turn on the other side and I'm like, not today.
That's not an uncommon feeling in the week sort of before the period when progesterone is elevated, but both progesterone and estrogen are starting to fall, but they have been elevated. And what I would say is there's no reason why you can't perform well. So the last thing we want to do is say to athletes, you can't run well, or you can't lift well, or you can't fight well during this week. What we potentially want to give advice to is if you are going to have a recovery week, then put it in that week that you don't feel great.
All right.
And so then you can get the most out of the weeks that you are feeling great.
Yeah.
The danger in doing that all of the time is that your gold medal match might fall in that particular week that you don't feel great, and then you haven't ever trained in that week, and so it's you're almost training your body not to perform well then. But for the most part, if we want to get the best adaptations, the greatest adaptations, and optimize training, then we should train when we feel great.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's a psychological thing. If you feel like, oh God, I'm in week four. Oh no, I'm not going to be able to perform. Yeah.
That's right. We don't want that. Yeah. That's right. No. Exactly. So having said that, ensuring that we keep that in the back of our mind, and that on occasion we do push in that particular week, the last, you know, the late luteal phase. But for the most part, training when we do feel good, which is the follicular phase.
Absolutely.
Is there any specific food that could be beneficial to eat at different points of the cycle to help?
There is some
apart from chocolate.
Yeah, well, that's every day of the cycle. That's not restricted on any day.
And we need the magnesium.
Look, there's things we can do to try to reduce inflammation. And so when we are bleeding, there is some evidence to suggest that oxidative stress and inflammation is increased. We are shedding the lining of our uterus, and that doesn't go without some stress to the body. And that may cause some bloating. And what we want to be able to do is not eat foods that contribute to that. If you're an elite athlete, I dare say you wouldn't be eating most of the foods that cause increased bloating and increased inflammation anyway. But potentially we should be more mindful of it, if you like. To eat anti-inflammatory foods, leafy greens, your blueberries, anything of colour, anything the colour purple, is going to stand you in good stead.
Anything the colour purple?
Absolutely, yeah. Anything the colour purple. Yeah, really? Absolutely.
What's eggplant in the colour?
Oh, of course. It's a big name that I can't pronounce.
Fair enough.
Well, I'll get it to you, absolutely. I'm pretty sure it's in red wine as well, so.
Oh, Shanti loves that. You just made her day.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
You know, raspberries, anything very, very red or purple, you can bet it's got wonderful anti-inflammatory properties.
Amazing.
That's really, really cool. Can you, just after talking about the optimal training for someone who's an elite athlete, what about menopausal women training? Because that is
a topic that's not discussed.
Yeah, it seems to be left out a little bit.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I guess, you know, menopause can go for a number of months and years. And so, again, it's incredibly variable. And it can be the case that there's absence of periods and then return. There is irregularity in the fluctuation of estrogen and progesterone right through menopause, which causes, you know, even further symptoms and dysfunction. On top of that, you've got problems with core temperature control. And so there's a lot of time where, you know, you've heard that the hot flushes, which makes exercise even more uncomfortable. So depending on the level of athlete will depend on how one treats exercise and training in menopause, and I suspect that training would be changed significantly around that time. But again, there's no reason why older athletes can't perform well at any stage. It's just managing symptoms is the most important thing. We don't want to be running out in the sun at 35 degrees if we're also having a hot flush and finding it hard to control core body temperature.
Absolutely. And so core body temperature, that's to do with progesterone, is that correct?
Well, it's actually both. So progesterone increases core body temperature, while estrogen helps to maintain it at the lower level or decrease estrogen. Interestingly, women on oral contraception tend to have a slightly elevated core body temperature. And we've done some research showing that blood flow might be increased slightly to the skin to try to maintain core body temperature in women on oral contraception compared to those naturally cycling. Whether or not that has implications for performance, so that if you can imagine individuals performing in endurance events in the heat, those on oral contraception may have to send more blood to the skin to maintain core body temperature, meaning that they've got less to send to the working muscle, may end up with premature fatigue. There isn't the evidence to support that in terms of a performance outcome yet, but certainly physiologically we know that women on oral contraception have a resting core body temperature that it's almost half a degree higher, which is reasonably significant if you're an athlete.
Oh, yeah, I can feel it so strongly in week four. And I'm not an elite athlete at all. I wanted to ask, because part of what Women Who Fight does is try to learn from research. We're a platform that tries to sort of show the research and show what's going on, because we're not experts at all. So we just want to sort of be a voice for it. And one of the things that we come across is that there's not much research around women. And I wanted to just see if you'd could talk about that a little bit, and I guess like how it's changing, because I mean it's hugely, am I correct in saying that the amount of research around women is significantly lower done on men?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess you can view it sort of in two ways. One is in general health and medical science. It's certainly the case that women-only studies are about 30% of men's, which is a lot lower, but it's absolutely worse in sports science. So up until about 10 years ago, female-only studies made up about 4% of all sports science studies in the research literature. Yes, it's pretty significant. It's definitely changing. It's definitely changed over the last 5 years. There's been a significant increase in female-only studies. They're incredibly hard to do if you recognize the physiological effects of the menstrual cycle. So people tend to steer away from that. There's been a couple of papers recently indicating that all studies in female participants should consider the menstrual cycle. Now, I'm not necessarily in agreement with that. I think we could report at what phase the women were in the menstrual cycle, but I think if we go down a path of having to take, and there is no point of care blood analyzer that measures estrogen yet.
Oh, really?
So we always have to go to the lab to get estrogen concentrations. Then, you know, that's a significant burden, if you like, on research budgets, on researchers, etc. And so they tend to turn away from doing research on women for that particular reason. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think we should be including women in all our studies. Unless there's a reason not to do so. I think what annoys me a little bit is that even to this day, in the big physiology textbooks, even the exercise science textbooks, there's 13 chapters, and then the 14th chapter is special populations, and one of those special populations is women. And I find that a little prehistoric, to tell you the truth.
Only 50% of the world.
Well, more actually. 51 exactly. So I think that's got to change. I think we've got to do, you know, if you're doing a study, it's got to include both men and women, unless there's a reason not to do so. And one of those reasons would be if you're looking at the effect of menstrual cycle on performance, and so you'd look at women. And if you were looking at the effect of testosterone in men, then fine. You know, if there's a reasonable reason not to include both men and women in a study, that so be it. But otherwise, I really believe that both men and women should be included.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And do you think, so you say that is changing, and is there anything that can be done to help continue to change?
Yeah, look, it is changing. If I talk just to sports science, I think one of the reasons is because we are having a increased, input of funding and profiling of women's sport. And so private companies, government funding is being channeled towards women, as it should be. And so there's a little more opportunity to get funding to do research in women. So that would be one major reason why. Secondly, I think, there's a lot more women in sports science research. So academics coming through, potentially 30 years ago, well, when I did my exercise science degree, there certainly wasn't half females in the lecture theatre there, not at all. I was one of very few girls doing sports science. Now I think that's absolutely evening up, so the chances of having female academics in the area of sports science and just having that natural interest. Most of us have played sport at some stage and have those questions in our own head. And I think we have to give the guys a little bit of slack where, you know, they become an academic. They're interested in how they played on the football field, right? We're all interested in our own physiology. We're all interested in the way we perform and play and recover. And so that's what's happened. But I think now there's been an increase in female academics in the area of sports science, and I think you'll start to see a lot more sports science research in
about time.
Yeah,
about time. Can you tell us about some of the research you've been doing?
Anything absolutely. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is all of the labs have been shut, of course, because of these interesting times that we're in at the moment. And so a lot of our research has been from a distance, and most of that research occurs via surveys. One of our most recent pieces was examining the knowledge that female athletes have around the menstrual cycle, and found incredibly poor results where they were answering questions at the rate of less than 50%.
Really?
Only 18% of female, and we're talking about elite female athletes, only 18% recognised what amenorrhea was. And so they don't even recognise what an absence of menstrual period is. So knowing that it's a problem is way off their radar. And we're starting to ask questions about, well, if their knowledge is poor, how do we better educate our athletes? Why is this message not getting through? Why aren't we having effective conversations with our athletes, and how can we better do that? So we're exploring what the barriers are in terms of knowledge transfer for our female athletes. And we, what is on the back burner at the moment in terms of being in the lab is really exploring this effect of core body temperature on performance in women on and off combined pill. So that's been halted for the moment, but we'll certainly continue to pick up on that.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Yeah. I mean, it all sounds fascinating. Why do you think there's a barrier between, you know, not these elite female athletes not getting the knowledge that they need?
Is it because we are not being taught that in school the right way?
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, I do believe it's considered an embarrassing topic. And again, I've thought about this a lot. I don't think we'll get ever to a situation where girls are necessarily really comfortable talking about it. I think of bowel disturbances and gut issues. Girls are never going to talk about that in a way that they are completely comfortable. And so it sort of sits that, well, maybe they're not going to just reach out to every coach that comes along and talk about it. Where we want to get to is them having the knowledge to know who to ask and when to ask. And we also have to identify whose responsibility is it to provide them with this information. So is it the responsibility of the organisation, if we're talking about female athletes? Is it the responsibility of the coach? Mm. And does the coach have that knowledge? Is there an opportunity in their daily training environment to have these conversations, or do they just turn up to training and come home? So we're looking to think, you know, so it's the opportunity, it's the environment, it's the knowledge of both the coach and the athlete, or the other support staff there. And of course, then whose responsibility is it? So we're trying to identify those things first. And then once we understand what the barriers are, we'll try to figure out the best pathway and the best advice that we could give our athletes, and then we'll encourage our national sporting organisations to have this information readily available, particularly to young female athletes and parents.
Absolutely. Definitely. I was just thinking as well, because we train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and our platform is predominantly for women in combat sports, and that's quite an explosive, it's not endurance. I mean, you can endure for 5 minutes, but that's not quite the same as running 100 miles or something. Mm-hmm. Do men and women differ at all in endurance? Because we've read an interesting study about it, and I don't know what if you've ever looked into it.
Yeah, endurance is an interesting one. It's I guess it encompasses a lot of things. If you look at endurance performance, it's made up or it's, you know, determined by a lot of different physiological factors. You know, VO2 peak is a great measure of endurance, but it's not the be-all and end-all. There's also sort of anaerobic threshold and critical power. And endurance can be anything. You could literally call endurance anything over about 1 minute because to fuel anything over 1 minute, you're predominantly using the aerobic energy system. So anything over 1 minute, all of a sudden, you're predominantly using your aerobic energy system. So there's some argument to suggest that that could be called endurance from then onward. But we don't think of you know, sort of two-minute exercise as endurance. In fact, if you exercised all out for 2 minutes, so if you got on your bike and started cycling as hard as you can for 2 minutes, you would probably reach peak oxygen uptake. And so you're stressing your aerobic energy system as highly as possible. But typically we think of endurance as marathon running, you know, maybe 10 kilometers and up. So we're sort of thinking 30 minutes and more as endurance. And that's the practical application of it. Now, men for the last numerous amounts of years have been able to maintain, you know, higher endurance than women. If you break it down to a muscle quality level, there are no differences. So pound for pound, centimeter, cubic centimeter, there are no differences in endurance between men and women's muscle, if you like, muscle quality. But they have more muscle and they have bigger lungs and they've got more blood volume. So they're able to perform better during tasks that last longer than 30 minutes. Where there seems to be a slight advantage is in ultra endurance in women. We have greater fat stores. We have the potential for greater fat oxidation and being able to maintain, you know, energy output for a very long time. So we're talking ultra endurance.
That's interesting.
We're in the wrong sport, Marina.
We're not even sort of talking Iron Man. You know, you know that the men are coming in sort of half an hour faster than the women. We're talking ultra endurance, 24 hours, that kind of exercise. When they do 24 hours of swimming, when they cross in English Channel, the women tend to do very, very well. Again, there's probably not that groundswell of women that participate in ultra endurance, but I think that's coming. And you will see potentially where men and women sort of come together at a certain event.
Okay. That's interesting. That's good. We've got to take up some endurance running now.
Definitely not for me.
Oh, definitely not for me either. Oh, it'd be terrifying. So another question for you is male PTs and coaches, all PTs and coaches, why is it important that they know about these sorts of things? And, you know, if so, why? Like what
difference can they make if they know more
or is it about the athlete just knowing their bodies and adjusting?
There's absolutely responsibility on every individual to understand more about their own health. Absolutely. But I think that PTs don't get enough information on female athletes. A lot of the information comes from what we know about men and we just transfer it to women. And for the most part, that's fine. But I think that so many women have menstrual dysfunction, don't have normal periods, that they could make an incredible contribution to their clients' health and to their clients' well-being and to their clients' performance if they just knew a little bit more about female physiology. They don't have to be an expert, but asking the question, knowing those four things about what is a normal menstrual cycle, when did you get your first period, is it occurring, on a regular basis. Is the actual period reasonable in terms of its flow and the length, the duration? And if you ask those simple questions, if the answer to any of those is no, or I can't train today because I'm in so much pain because of my menstrual cycle, then just to say, please go and see your general practitioner. That's not normal. And I think just knowing that that's not normal okay. is a huge contribution to women in sport because, you know, changing well-being and changing health would really improve the outlook women have in terms of their activity levels and playing sport. And I believe a lot of girls give up exercise at around the age that they're getting their period, probably because it's not comfortable. And that's sad. We need to improve that, and we have a responsibility to do that.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Perfect. All right, the last question we ask every guest that we bring in our podcast is a very personal question. So, Claire, yes. What are you fighting for?
Wow, that's such a great question. Personally, I'm fighting for health, well-being, and happiness. I think I'm fighting for my community to leave a legacy, whereby more girls want to play sport. And if that means knowing what a normal menstrual cycle is, then fantastic. And look, I think sort of on a more global, aspect, I think I'm fighting for, and I'll keep it pretty, specific to science. I'm fighting for more knowledge about how to optimize performance in every individual, whether that be a male or a female. I'm spending my time and my effort on women. I'm a woman, and I'm interested in my own physiology. So I think I'm fighting to optimize everyone's ability to perform at their best.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's so lovely.
Keep
to
doing
hear.
It. We love it. Love that.
Yeah. We're so thrilled that we had this opportunity to talk
it's
to you.
It's been really, really lovely.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And please keep in touch. We want to know more about your findings.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Email me anytime. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Oh,
brilliant.
We'll be very, very happy to share anything you want us to.
Yeah.
Terrific. Right. Yeah, I have a very good friend who fights Dewey, and she absolutely loves it. And we talk about this stuff all the time. So, yeah, it's been really good.
Oh, amazing.
Lucky them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Claire.
Have a lovely day.
Yeah. Have a lovely... Oh, yes, it's our evening. It's your morning.
You're starting your day.
Good night to you. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and share. And check out other episodes, which can be found on our website and the Apple Podcast app.